they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to it on Apple, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at popularresistance.org, and while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. So this week, I spoke with two guests, and the topic was the crisis in our food system. We already have a very fragile food system globally, and the current U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is worsening that fragility and is likely to lead to significant food shortages and high food prices this coming fall. And so I spoke with Kayla Dones. She's an editor with DD Geopolitics, and she wrote about the impact of China's new ban on fertilizer exports, how that's going to impact food supplies. And also she talked about how there's a history of when there are food shortages, they lead to significant civil unrest. She talks also about what we need to do to prepare for the coming food shortages. And then I also spoke with Lauren Borsheim. Lauren is a food policy analyst for Food and Water Watch, and she follows farming legislation at the state and national level. And right now, there is the latest iteration of the Farm Bill going through Congress. And Lauren talks about how that is going to further consolidate corporate control of our food system instead of supporting the smaller farmers and making sure that we have food security, that we have access to the food that we need for everyone. She talks about how we can impact that legislation to advocate for a better version of that bill. Before I get to those interviews, I wanted to talk about mainly food security, and I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about the fragility of our food system because, you know, while right now we're under the Trump administration, but the decline in our food system has been going on for a long time through both Democratic and Republican-controlled administrations. We've been, for decades now, losing our small and medium farms, particularly Black-owned farms have been under attack. And this is largely because of legislation that has removed support for them, or it has created higher burdens of paperwork and regulations that farmers have to navigate. And of course, these types of regulations favor the larger enterprises because they have the staff and the funds to deal with all of this paperwork. And then, you know, the prices for inputs have been rising. There's corporate control of our seeds and the need for fertilizer and pesticides, the push for monocrops and the growing number of factory farm operations are all, you know, taking over our farms and making it really difficult for local farmers. There also are obstacles to repairing farm equipment. And so it's not easy for farmers. It's hard to find a place to repair their equipment. They're not able to get access to the information and the parts that they need to repair their own equipment. So there's been a growing movement of right to repair for farmers as well. And then on top of this are things that are more difficult to control, like the impact of the climate crisis, which is causing droughts and floods, major storms and damage. And Robert Hunziker, who I've interviewed before, he does a great job of reporting on the state of the climate. And his most recent article in Counterpunch writes that CO2 emissions globally from fossil fuels and industry totaled 38.11 billion metric tons in 2025. And this is a record high. He writes that the rate of global warming more than doubled for the first time in human history in only one decade. Emissions in the United States are rising. And of course, the U.S. is a huge producer and exporter of fossil fuels. And as a result, Dr. James Hansen of the Earth Institute has stated that, quote, the pace of global heating has been significantly underestimated and the international 2 degrees Celsius target is dead. People have been advocating for making changes to limit the amount of global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, but we've already overshot that and we're likely to go beyond 2 degrees Celsius. So all of this means, you know, that we're going to be seeing more severe storms, more climate chaos, more impacts on our food system as a result of that. And unfortunately, particularly in the United States, there's been a failure to put in place the systems and the programs that we need to reduce emissions, create more cleaner, renewable forms of energy. And so that's having an impact. And then add to that, under this current Trump administration, the assault on migrant farm workers. And of course, this is another thing that's been going on, you know, both through Democratic and Republican administrations, attacks on immigrants in the United States. But we're seeing that escalate currently. And so, you know, are we going to have enough workers to work on the farms and to pick and process the food that we need? That's a big concern. And then looking at the current U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, this is causing shortages of fuel and raising the cost of that. And there's also shortages of fertilizer, as I'll get into in a little bit. And then on top of that, in the United States, our population of farmers is aging. And some farmers are just finding, as they don't have someone to take over the farm as they age out of being able to continue to farm, it becomes more lucrative to sell their land to developers than it does to continue to farm it. And then we've got tech companies that are pressuring farmers to buy their farmland so they can build data centers. The data centers require massive amounts of water, massive amounts of power to fuel this artificial intelligence boom that's also displacing workers. As you're probably aware, this past week, Oracle fired 30,000 employees through a 6 a.m. email that they sent saying you no longer have your job, and then they were cut off from their accounts, their work accounts on their computers. We've got this spiraling crisis that's happening, and we're going to need to do something about it. And that's part of what we talk about in the interviews. But I wanted to share with you an article by Michael LePage in The New Scientist. He's the New Scientist environmental reporter. And he writes about how in the 1970s, we had a global food crisis. The prices of food went very high due to the energy crisis at that time. But he writes that this current food crisis that's looming could be much worse than that. He factors in the war, fuel, fertilizer, and pesticide prices are rising just as farmers are deciding what they want to plant. And he says that these, you know, shortages and rising prices are going to last for quite a long time. Already, fertilizer prices are up 44%. And he says that three of the global naphtha exporters, naphtha is used to produce pesticides, were hit by bombs in March. One was in Russia, two were in the Gulf Coast countries. And he writes that this is really a perfect storm when you add in the climate crisis, and also that we have a rise in the production of biofuel from food. So now 5% of food calories are going in to produce biofuels. In the European Union, this is the equivalent of 15 million loaves of bread every day are being burned for fuel. In the United States, 30% of our corn that's grown is used to produce bioethanol. And so just as we need to be producing more food, there's a real big push to grow crops that can be used to produce fuel. Michael LePage suggests that it would be important for us to transition to a diet where we get more of our protein from beans and legumes, because those are crops that produce their own fertilizer, rather than getting our protein from meat, which means we have to grow food crops and feed that to the animals. And of course, we know that that means that there's a much higher cost of producing food to feed the animals so they can feed us is just not a workable solution. Kayla Dones wrote a recent article about how China, which is the world's largest fertilizer producer, has just this year decided to ban exports of nitrogen fertilizers. And she also wrote that three of the top urea producers, urea is used to make fertilizer, ship through the Strait of Hormuz. And that this is coming on top of the fact that in the European Union, due to the war on Russia and the gas shortages that have resulted in the European Union from that, has decreased fertilizer production in the European Union. In her article, she also writes about the American Farm Bureau Federation is reporting that many farmers, row crop farmers, are already facing 4 or 5 straight years of operational losses, even after factoring in crop insurance and emergency federal assistance. And so farmers are having to decide right now, are they going to go ahead and plant crops? I mean, right now, it costs more to grow corn than it can be sold for. And she writes that farmers are likely to shift more to things like soybeans instead of growing corn. You know, in the United States, there are already 47 million people who were food insecure before the war began, but we're expecting this fall to see that food insecurity grow. And there are other impacts that the war on Iran is having, including drug shortages. Hospital supply chains are struggling to get surgical anesthetics, cancer medicines, and even basic IV fluids. And as we're facing these shortages, is the government taking the action that it needs? No, the Trump administration is threatening cuts to daycare and to Medicare and to Medicaid. Ben Norton of Geopolitical Economy recently interviewed Michael Hudson about how the war is impacting the global economy, and he says that every country on the planet is being affected because this war on Iran has created the largest oil shock in history. He says larger than the oil shocks of 1973 and 1979. And so some of the impacts that this is having already, the Philippines has declared a state of national emergency. Many countries are releasing their oil reserves, which Michael Hudson says is just a Band-Aid. It's not going to solve the problem. It's just a temporary solution. In the European Union, the European Commission is urging people to work from home if they're able to drive less, to fly less, and for EU countries to urgently roll out renewables, because they say even if peace were to come tomorrow, nothing is going to go back to normal for the foreseeable future. In India, they're already rationing fuel and closing down industries. And this is also impacting small businesses because there is a shortage of cooking fuel. In Sri Lanka, they're rationing fuel and they're giving workers an extra day off each week on Wednesdays. In Bangladesh, they're restricting the use of electricity in government buildings and they're holding school virtually. And in Pakistan, they're almost out of the gas that they use to produce 20% of electricity for the country. Now, there are things that we can do to weather this crisis. One thing we can do is we can look to the people in Cuba. You know, Cuba has been under an economic blockade for more than 60 years now. They've been facing a severe fuel shortage this year as the Trump administration has clamped down on fuel shipments. There were no fuel shipments to Cuba until recently when a Russian tanker was able to get through. Medea Benjamin was there recently on a convoy, the Nuestra America convoy that brought aid to Cuba. And she wrote about how hunger is growing in Cuba. Farmers, like we're going to be facing, don't have the fuel or the inputs. Even if they can grow the food, it's difficult for them to get it to the market. But she said, you know, across the island, they've been finding ways to feed themselves, experimenting with agroecology and getting local inputs and using cooperative models and just finding creative ways to grow food with fewer resources. In the United States, we have some pretty big tasks ahead of us in order to bring about a better food system, a more resilient and stronger food system. And one of those is to break up big agriculture. We have a real monopolization of our food system. There are two companies that own 90% of the genetic traits of domestic corn, soybeans, and cotton. There are four companies that control 81% of the beef market, and 65% of the pork market, and 55% of the poultry market, and two companies that control 74% of all of the milk. So they're, you know, able to raise prices as they want to, and there's not a lot that we can do about it until we break those up. There are places like Cuba and others that have really been taking steps to support farmers and to create food sovereignty. And I recently posted an article on Popular Resistance about a network in France. It's called the Agricultural Machinery Cooperatives, the CUMA. And they have more than 10,000 local branches throughout France. And it's basically a cooperative for farmers of all different types who share farm equipment, share knowledge, help each other out, use mutual aid. And so that's something that we really need here in the United States so we can empower our smaller farmers and keep them growing food. Also, Kayla writes about in her article things that we can do at the household level. She suggests that we start building a reserve of dry goods such as rice, legumes, oats, canned protein. She recommends having a 3-month staple. This will be good if there are shortages, but also help out when food prices are very high. She recommends finding out what foods are produced locally and, you know, finding ways that you can have access to that. At the community level, a lot of places have been putting into action these local food networks, trying to get, you know, farm to table distribution. There's also a lot of work to create community gardens and urban farming collectives. Kayla reports, you know, that these are necessary infrastructure that we need to be looking into. And of course, there are farmer markets, food cooperatives, and then CSAs are really important. This is community supported agriculture. And this is where a household buys into a farm. You know, you pay the farm directly, and then each week you get fresh produce to eat. And this supports it, you know, when you're paying up front at the beginning of the growing season, and then each week you get some food. This is a way for the farmers to have that money they need to plant and grow the food. And it supports, you know, our local agricultural systems. And this is also good, you know, the more that we can eat locally, of course, the lower the carbon footprint of our diet. And then also finding ways to reduce pesticide usage is going to be important. Most of the pesticides are used on crops that are grown to produce ethanol or for factory farm feed. So those are things that we need to be ending anyway. And in animals that are raised in factory farms are, you know, given a lot of food that has pesticides in it, as well as antibiotics. Those have health impacts, as well as creating pollution and contaminating our drinking water. Something that's been gaining in awareness, as well as, you know, there's regenerative farming, there's agroecology, but there's also indigenous agriculture. And that's getting more attention at the university level because there's a lot of research that shows that these traditional farming systems are much better at protecting the soil, reducing the loss of biodiversity. And so combining indigenous knowledge with other farming methods is a very powerful way to strengthen our food system. Now, in general, we need to be taking action on a range of issues. And one issue I wanted to raise that's coming up is the potential merger of two major railways, Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern. This would be a merger that would cross 43 states and create the first single line railroad linking the North American coasts. Rail workers, unions, and small family farmers are coming together to fight this merger because they say it will lead to fewer options for them to transport their food and higher transportation costs. And this will translate into also raising food prices. So this merger, they applied for it last year, was turned down in January, but they're going to refile by the end of April. Then once they file that, the Surface Transportation Board has 30 days to make a decision. So this is the time to be speaking out against this merger. Also, on July 1st, trade officials from the United States, Mexico, and Canada are going to be meeting to talk about changing the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, a large trade agreement that's also known as NAFTA 2.0. And this is corporatization of our trade. And so in May and June, activists are going to be holding all kinds of events to educate and speak out about this trade agreement. These are called the Days of Solidarity, and you can get information from daysofsolidarity.org if you want to participate in that. And then coming up very soon would be May Day on May 1st. And there's a lot of organizing going on across the United States for a no work, no school, no shopping on May 1st. So I'm going to stop there. We'll take a short musical break and then come back with the interviews with Kayla Dones and Lauren Borsheim.
One cup of coffee, 150. Guy who picked the coffee didn't get three. Stuck in the belly of an industry that doesn't care about people. Working on the hills on stolen land, picking at the earth with a scuffed bare hand. Sweating for the profit of some rich man that doesn't care about people. Buy a piece of fruit at the grocery store, shipped from Guatemala, Chile, or El Salvador. Grown by orphan children of the Civil War that was funded by fruit corporations. A global trade system riding on the backs of families packed in Wallace shacks. Living in the fear of death squad attacks that are funded by fruit corporations. One pack of t-shirts, $4.50. Girl who sewed the t-shirts didn't get three. And she's trying to survive in an industry that doesn't care about people. Bangladesh factory, 16-hour shifts. No overtime breaks or benefits. And they'll fire her if she gets pregnant, cause they don't care about people. New York banks watch a Thai bot grow. Then they took Kaya Mountain.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Kayla Dones. Kayla is the founder of Protagonist News and the editor-in-chief of DD Geopolitics. Her investigative work focuses on national security, institutional policy, and U.S. foreign policy. Kayla, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Oh my goodness, Margaret, it's a pleasure. And just learning about all the things you have going on your side, I'm so excited to have met you. I'm so grateful.
Great. Yeah, likewise. So let's start out by telling the listeners about DD Geopolitics. What is that?
DD Geopolitics is ran by a good friend of mine. Her name's Sarah. I feel like we have really similar brains in how we look at the world. We just go about it in different ways, but she has built the most amazing platform that covers international geopolitics. And she has writers and contributors all over the world. And I'm just blessed to be over there. They do podcasts, Telegram, Substack, X accounts. I mean, they are on every platform doing incredible work. And I'm just a part of the Substack, a little tiny part of this, where we're really focusing in and leaning in on uplifting voices of people around the world and how policy is impacting their lives, how current events are impacting them. So we have writers from the Middle East, we have writers from Southern America, all over the world. We have people contributing, and so we can really get the full scope of what's happening in the world.
And so folks can find that at ddgeopolitics.substack.com.
Yes.
So let's talk about the topic that I wanted to speak with you about today. And, there's been a lot of talk about how the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has impacted fuel supplies, oil and gas, but there's not a lot of talk about how this is impacting food availability, especially in the global north as we begin our growing season. The agricultural production relies on fossil fuels for farming equipment and transportation. And then there's also the need for fertilizer. You wrote an article, The Famine Signal: China's Fertilizer Embargo and the Global Hunger Crisis No One Is Preparing For, at DD Geopolitics. Can you talk about, China just told its exporters to stop shipping nitrogen, potassium fertilizer. You write about how that's been kind of declining over time. What's going on there and what's driving that?
Yeah, well, I saw a post, and I don't even remember where, but it mentioned briefly that China had shut off the fertilizer exports. And, I started off locally as an investigative journalist. And I mean, even 10 years ago, I was interviewing our farmers because I live in the Central Valley of California. And so I've always been tuned into the crops, the agriculture, organic farming. And so, when all of this first started happening, the farmers have been impacted for years. We have a crisis in regards to growing food on our own soil nationwide, And so I've always kept tabs and a finger on the pulse with what the farm community, what their impacts are, what they're going through. And so when I saw this, that's why I did a subtitle saying from the Central Valley Farms to Sub-Saharan Hunger Lines. And so we're going to see impacts throughout the world. And there's 2.1 billion people that are in critical zones. But we are absolutely going to be feeling the impacts of it here at home as well, in regards to food prices. And it's just, for me, I look at it and I think to myself, well, what are the solutions? So right now I'm currently looking at regenerative farming, and looking at some of the local places here in my own backyard that have community gardens and things of that nature, just to look at it at the grassroot level. But like for as for the entire system, I don't have answers for that, but I think it's important to bring attention to the issues.
Yeah, and I want to dig into kind of more of the points that you brought up in that article. But just to open with, China, you wrote, has been cutting back on its exports since 2021. Do you know what's driving that?
I think that there may be a short-term strategy to it. It may be a long-term, but really, I think that we need to lean on the geopolitical experts in regards to what is actually driving that. There's a lot of nuance, but obviously, food sources you can be weaponized, right? And so there's concerns of is that the intention? Or are they unable to produce at that level? What's actually going on?
Instability in the world and uncertainty. And of course, what we see countries that are targeted typically do kind of hunker down and focus on their own abilities to make sure that they can be food sovereign and energy sovereign so that whatever is happening out there, they try to insulate themselves from that. We see that in countries like,
Absolutely. I
Nicaragua.
don't want to I don't want to say there's ill intent behind China, China's choice to do that. It's just we need to look at it more. We need to look at it
Right.
more closely. Yeah.
Right. So can you talk about for the listeners, like what's happening right now in terms of, particularly for the United States, the price of fertilizer, the availability of fertilizer for this growing season?
If I could summarize it, it costs more to grow the corn than to sell the corn. And that's an issue. I mean, the profit margins are so small that these farm I mean, farmers are going bankrupt. They're selling their farms. Fourth generation farmers are just, giving up because the system has completely collapsed on them. And it's amazing. Even the equipment, There's, these farmers, I understand it's on gas or whatever, the diesel, whatever. Let's find some solutions here, people, because if a farmer is expected to invest in equipment every 5 years to keep it up to the, whatever the standard is, we are crushing the people that are growing our food. It's insane. And so in the article, I say, rather than donating to your pastors, go donate to your farmers.
Right.
That's where the money's needed, you
Yeah.
know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, like for instance, one of my adult sons in his work, he does conversions of combustion engines to electric. And so one of their big products is kits for farmers to convert their tractors from gas to an electric tractor. So folks are trying to work on these solutions. But right now, I guess our agricultural sector is heavily dependent on fossil fuels and these fertilizers that many of the inputs come from abroad. Is that
Yeah,
correct?
it absolutely. And Margaret, I think that we should take this moment as a way to look at the structure, the systems that we have in place, what's working and what's broken. And whatever's broken, throw it out and figure out, best steps forward. It is mind-blowing to me that more raw milk farms have been raided than the actual pedophiles that we're seeing on Epstein's list. You know what I'm saying? Like we are funneling resources to raid raw milk farms. There's like raw milk underground black markets because of how many regulations there are on our food. Something people have been drinking and consuming since, I don't know, we've been on the planet, And so it's just there's lots of systemic issues here. Fertilizer being fundamental. And I think taking this moment, do we want the GMO fertilizer in our soil? Or do we want to find another solution? If we can't access that fertilizer that was already hurting our soil, hurting our crops, hurting our population, maybe in this gap, in this moment where we don't have it, we can figure out some solutions.
One thing I thought that was really interesting in your article was you wrote about how the impact of food shortages on civil society. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the history and what the current shortages may be leading to?
Absolutely. This is another issue that I'm really passionate about and I've covered in different ways. And before we started recording, you were talking about Occupy Wall Street. And I interviewed Micah White. His title, he says, is one of the co-founders of Occupy Wall Street in the New York region. He created this book. You may be familiar and your audience might be familiar, but it was fascinating. And it's called The End of Protest. And it talks about how masses of people going into the streets rarely ever changes the system, and it's just this way for people to just burn off steam and frustration. But what happens? I mean, we've seen riots come out of these moments, and it's actually more devastation to local communities than it does to change whatever the cause is, right? To some extent, if we're looking at the numbers. And in this book, The End of Protest, he identifies, and this is actually a university that did this study in regards to bread riots. And when bread hits a certain price tag, there's uprisings. And we could see this in Egypt. I pointed to the Egyptian bread riots. And this was actually, it was the New England, for anyone that's interested in this study, it's called New England Complex Systems Institute, where they identify different variables and the science of food crises, right? And so they kind of, they pair these civil unrest moments to a lack of being able to afford food. I mean, it makes sense, it's like, you have this certain faith. Like, I am a part of this system, and I'm paying my taxes or I'm doing my due diligence. I'm showing up and being a good citizen with the understanding that there's going to be food provided for my family on the table. When that option goes away, it causes quite a bit of friction within populations. So I've been keeping an eye on this. It was back in 2025, they had in California a massive food bank cuts that were happening. And so it was a $9 million cut And I think it was something like 27% of Californians rely on food bank resources to get the extra little staples that they need. And so I went in and I embedded with the warehouse all the way to the distribution line, taking a look at how things come in, how they're packaged. It was interesting. The distribution warehouse is actually partnered with local farmers. So people were actually getting access to locally grown food, which I appreciated. And there was actual contracts with the farmers that allowed them to sell a certain amount. So that budget cut was also impacting the farmers to be able to have those sales. And then going all the way into the food distribution line where people were sleeping in their cars from 2 a.m. in the morning just to get one bag of food, and that was 2025 pre-war with Iran and fertilizers being cut. And so, and I will say that food distribution center, they just got shut down. And so we are seeing this local impact where we, even the resources and the backup systems in place when times get tough, they are being cut, they are being hit, they are being removed. And so we are going to have a lot of empty space come September when food prices are through the roof. And so what I'm telling to local activists and organizers is start paying attention to the food distribution in your communities and start ramp up, get ready. Because it's gonna hit come September, and then it's a ripple effect from there. I mean, it's gonna take years for this system to stabilize again.
Or if it does, I mean, we're facing
Or if it
a
does,
lot of
right.
uncertainty. We also have the climate crisis, and that's been taking a toll on agriculture as well. Some areas are in drought, some areas are getting too much rain or are flooding. Certainly, what's happening right now in this war with all the release of the carbon into the atmosphere is not going to be a good thing. So, what can you talked about finding out where your food's coming from in your local community? You made some other recommendations in your article as well. What do you think folks should be focusing on right now?
Well, like I said, I've been doing my best to educate my community locally. And I think that educating goes a long way because education, the next step after that is activation, right? You have good information, you know what's coming down the pipeline. So, how do you activate and organize around that? And I think that the more that we are, prepared, I mean, our system is so corrupt. At this point, I think, community and grassroots is kind of all we got. The institutional failure, I mean, we're watching the American empire crumble in front of our eyes. So I think, just really locking in with good people locally, tapping in with your family and your loved ones and building those in-person connections. Margaret, I'll tell you, another thing I encourage your listeners to do, I just recently did a community event, and it was based on some ICE detention center footage that, it was a whole story that I did in regards to these ICE detention centers. And rather than just distributing this information online, which is, I mean, half of the people doing the real work, we're censored, we're blocked, we're the algorithms don't favor us, right? So rather than throwing it out into the abyss and hoping that it lands somewhere, I'm like, I'm organizing around this. I'm going to tell this information to people in person. And I'm telling you, there were people in that room I've never met before in my life. There was probably like two open seats available. It was a full house. And I started with the data. Then I went into the conversation of, it was a debate between someone on the left and the right and their thoughts on ICE detention centers. So both sides were represented. There was agreement. I mean, both men walked away from that conversation respecting each other, saying that they have a seat at one another's table because it was so insightful and in-depth, the topics that we talked about. And then afterwards, we had a community discussion that went on for almost an hour where every single person in that room shared insights. And one of the biggest things we walked away from was, oh my God, we need to talk about these issues in person. We cannot keep these conversations online. It is not enough. We need to see how we're being impacted. We need to be able to support each other and have solidarity for people to be seen, to be heard, to express, to understand and process. We have had so much happen to us. I mean, since 9/11, post 9/11, we're in a new world. I mean, and so how is that impacting your local community? And it was just, it was, everyone walked away a little bit changed with a
Yeah.
little bit of a different perspective. And so I encourage all of your audience to take the issues that are important to you and take it offline
Right.
and go sit down at a cafe, go have an event, have a conversation, because at this point, like, it's needed.
So you talked about in the article, kind of it's not a matter of if we're going to have shortages this coming fall, but a matter of are we going to be prepared for it. So you mentioned that folks should be stocking up on staples. You talked about people focusing on planting gardens. You mentioned already supporting local farmers. And then you mentioned something, regenerative agriculture. And in the article, I think you talk about agroecology. Can you talk a little bit about what those are?
Yeah, so that's an issue that I'm just learning about. And I was supposed to meet with someone today and then I got stacked up. But I think that this idea, our soil has intelligence. And you know, I was watching this scientist and she was saying, you know, we cannot replicate soil in labs. Like they just can't do it. And so there's something that's so magical and deep and alive about our earth, and what we're pouring into it is not it's not the way, you know? And so this regenerative agriculture is kind of utilizing the soil, the plants, the environment around you to create abundance in where you're at. And so you know, I'm learning. I'm very new to the topic, but if people want to reach out about it, and if you guys know more, I would love to learn more, because this is going to be an ongoing thing that I'm writing about here over at DD Geopolitics.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, yeah, with regenerative agriculture, it's about planting crops that put nutrients and carbon back into the soil to make that soil richer without these kind of fossil fuel based inputs. And then agroecology is something that's used widely in Central America and South America. In fact, there's an Institute of Agroecology that teaches farmers all around Central and South America about how to use these practices. Of again, you know, keeping that soil full of nutrients, growing food in ways that can, they try to find out how can you reduce the water inputs that are needed. So just trying to find ways to grow food as we find that our resources are becoming more and more limited.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, I think the more that we can work with the environment around us in a natural way, we can bring back a sense of balance to our communities, our environment, our world. So very important issues.
I just wanted to just one last quick question. You mentioned that, you know, in the United States, we will be impacted, kind of gave the impression that we should be able to weather this. But there, you mentioned that 2.1 billion people are in critical exposure zones. Can you just quickly tell the listeners a little bit about where those zones are and what we can expect coming out of those
Yeah, not a
areas?
problem. So it was Belize and India. Now it's for two separate reasons. You know, with Belize, it's they really depend on this fertilizer. They're very, very dependent. Now with India, it's due to the fact that their population is rising at a rate that is not sustainable with the food exports. And so you can see, I have this chart where you can see the two lines in the graph going in opposite directions. And so that's really why there's a high risk over there. And then I do have a map, if anyone's interested, kind of highlighting the regions that are high risk, you know, other regions that will experience significant distress and then moderate. So yeah, it's gosh, I don't even know the numbers of the human impact. I mean it's there, but I just it's hard to fathom
Right.
the crisis that's on the horizon.
Right. And I know a lot of the trade agreements that we have around the world have requirements of how much countries are expected to export. And it'll be interesting to see the pressure on that because those are kind of agreements that they're locked into, but you may find countries are being forced to export products that they're going to need at home. There may be shortages at home. So, like you said, this is a hugely systemic global problem and it impacts so many different sectors. So, we definitely need to be thinking of new solutions both locally and globally.
Absolutely.
Any final
Absolutely.
word for the listeners before we go?
Well, I want to say thank you so much for paying attention to this and doing your a little bit of research on my background and taking the time. I can tell you dive in and I respect that very much. And I'm excited to see, how our paths might cross in the future. You're doing
Sounds.
good work over there too.
Thank you. Yeah, same to you, Kayla. Well, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're really busy and you're not feeling well, but thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Absolutely. You got it. Enjoy the day.
And now I turn to my guest, Lauren Borsheim. Lauren is a food policy analyst with Food and Water Watch. Lauren, thank you so much for taking time to join me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm really interested to talk with you because there are a lot of concerns. I mean, our food system in the United States has not been doing well, and I think there are some new threats to it. And so I really wanted to talk with you about this new farm bill that's being put together and how that may help or not help us. But before we do that, can you talk about what Food and Water Watch is and what you do there?
Absolutely. So Food and Water Watch is a national environmental group. We fight for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate, something that we all deserve. Right now, we are pushing hard in Congress to pass a fair farm bill, which I know we'll talk about a little bit more. One that supports farmers and consumers and not big ag corporations, which the current draft of the farm bill does heavily benefit these big ag corporations. So at Food and Water Watch, I am a food policy analyst, which means that I break down these federal and state food laws and agricultural policies. I take the overly complicated legislative language and I make it accessible for everyone. I also engage with federal and state lawmakers. I have meetings and I share insights on how policies will impact Americans. And I ultimately push them to reform these policies and to better support our consumers and small farmers across this nation.
Great. Thank you so much. And very important work that you're doing. And I really appreciate Food and Water Watch in on a number of issues, being able to help us understand what's going on. Can you tell the listeners kind of what are your thoughts about where we are in the United States? What is the big picture situation with food and agriculture in the US?
So from the start of the Trump administration, our food system has been under attack. Beginning, we had these indiscriminate tariffs that caused prices to skyrocket for both farmers and consumers. We had the defunding of multiple food grant programs. A lot of them helped get local farmers' produce to these small community centers or even schools. So consumers love to see these. They got local products right to their plates. And now, as the trifecta, we have this disastrous farm bill that does nothing but support big agriculture. So right now, we have these small farmers across the nation that are struggling to afford to farm, and then consumers that are struggling to afford groceries. So it's almost this pipeline effect. From our small farm to our table at home, the food system is under significant stressors that can be fixed with a fair farm bill, but unfortunately, this current farm bill does nothing but make these problems worse.
Yeah, and that's the big concern that I have. We've seen just this growing corporatization and corporate control of our food system. While, as you said, the smaller farmers and the family farmers are really struggling, the ones who are connected to their communities and would help make sure that their community members have food. So can you talk about the farm bill? We have a new farm bill like every 2 years, is that correct?
So the Farm Bill is this key piece of legislation, and it sets the tone for ag policy across the nation. So normally we do have a Farm Bill every 5 years,
5 years.
so a little bit longer, but yeah, every 5 years. But due to our gridlock in Congress that none of us are shocked to hear about, we haven't had a new Farm Bill since 2018. It expired technically in 2023, but it has been extended 3 times. Most recently, it was extended back in January, and it is set to expire in September of this year. So by September of this year, we need either a new farm bill or an extension of the 2018 farm bill.
Right.
That's why there's this big push in Congress right now to get this policy through. It covers all things from food and ag policy. It covers certain crops and reference prices to conservation programs, ag research, even rural development and like community center building, which a lot of people don't think it covers that, but it does. And normally it covers things like nutrition, but this year this farm bill doesn't. So it, originally the farm bill was intended to support these small and mid-sized farmers, consumers, and rural communities, but it has this farm bill has strayed far from that mission. It is basically just a blatant handout to factory farming and these agricultural corporations.
Wow. Yeah. So I know you have expertise in particular areas of the farm bill. What are the ones, the areas that are concerning to you right now?
Yeah, so a main concern we're having is that this farm bill does nothing to address America's food affordability problem. I'm sure a lot of people have been feeling the crunch at the grocery store. And a lot of that stems from this one big ugly bill that passed last summer. So it cut $187 billion program, so supplement nutrition assistance program that millions of Americans rely on across the nation. So it did does nothing to address those cuts. It's a perfect opportunity to does nothing. It also does nothing to break up the corporate monopolies that are plague our agriculture system and drive prices higher for consumers and lower prices these small farmers get for their product. And second, the farm bill props up these corporate factory farms at the expense of family farms. The best example of this is this thing called the EATS Act, which has been repackaged in the Farm Bill. And it threatens both voters' rights to push key animal welfare standards. The most common one we all know of is California's Prop 12. And it might also push these small pork producers out of business. So it's kind of a double whammy there. It impacts both voters' rights and then also these small, the businesses of these small pork producers. The Farm Bill guts a fundamental conservation program, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. It removes $1 billion in federal funding from that program, which a lot of small farmers rely on to get conservation technology to their acres. It also allows states to prioritize certain polluting ag technologies. And these are all key signals that Congress isn't acting for the family farmer, but instead for these corporate agribusinesses. And then finally, a big thing here that you probably many people have maybe seen in the news is that the Farm Bill, it's siding with pesticide corporations over cancer patients. One provision of the Farm Bill, it is directly from Big Pesticides Policy Handbook. It strips control from people and it centralizes it in the hands of a few massive pesticide corporations like Bayer. It would create this federal uniformity in pesticide labeling, kind of air quotes around uniformity, because it stops states from mandating stronger health and safety warnings on pesticide products. So, when you see a warning label on a product, it's trying to make it to re only have the federal standard, but states can't put any others on there that maybe would protect consumers a little bit better. So the key thing about this law or this provision of the Farm Bill is that it would shield pesticide corporations from health-related lawsuits. So we have thousands upon thousands of lawsuits that are filed in federal court or state court from people that have cancer or Parkinson's disease or other health issues that have been linked to pesticide use. And this provision of the Farm Bill would basically close the courtroom doors to these people. They would not be able to go and plead their case to the court and get funding or money from these pesticide corporations for the harm that these consumers have suffered. So the key thing is that the Farm Bill is not a place that it should be bowing to pesticide giants. It should be protecting our small farmers, our farmers and consumers to ensure that individuals that have been harmed by these pesticides can have their voices heard in court. So all around, this Farm Bill is does not serve fa small farmers or consumers, but instead, in these key elements, it is really just serving big agriculture and factory farming.
Right. And some of these pesticides that are used in the United States, I understand other countries, particularly in the European Union, where they have provisions that, products must be safe before they can go onto the market. They don't allow the use of the same pesticides that we use here. Is that correct?
From what I believe, yes, yeah, there are other limits in the EU that we do not have here in the United States. Weirdly enough, the USDA, which is our agriculture department, doesn't fully regulate pesticides. It's the EPA. It's this partnership between USDA and EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency. So it is kind of a cross agency pipeline to get these pesticides onto our farmland. So yes, we do have different standards than the EU does for pesticides.
Right. And there's been such a a fight here in the United States to reduce or eliminate the use of pesticides like Roundup, like glyphosate. That, as you said, is connected to cancer. And there have been all these court cases that some have been won against Bayer.
Absolutely. There's been, even RF Kennedy Jr., who RFK Jr., who we see as the head of HHS, Health and Human Services. He himself has won cases against Bayer or Monsanto for health-related claims related to pesticides. So yeah, it's a big issue right now. The Supreme Court has a case. April 27th is when they will be hearing the pesticide case. So everyone tune in. We'll see what happens.
This is critical. So how can people learn more about this legislation?
Absolutely. So you can really tap into Food and Water Watch's resources. I've recently drafted and published a blog on Food and Water Watch's website, on covering a lot of things that we talked about a little bit more in depth. It is called "This Farm Bill is for Corporations, Not for Farmers or Families," and it might be a great starting point to learn more about what's going on in our ag space, especially with this farm bill. You can also subscribe to Food and Water Watch's emails to stay up to date on things, farm bill, food system, agricultural policy. We touch on a lot of other things too in the environmental space and even data centers. So if any of those things trigger your interest, feel free to subscribe to our emails. But there's a lot of resources out there, and it may seem complicated, but there are great starting points like my blog that can really give you kind of a jumping off point for where to go next.
Great. And if people want to get involved, if they want to meet with their member of Congress or get involved in their community, push back against this, do you have recommendations for what people can do?
The most important thing right now, and I cannot stress this enough, is to reach out to your representative. The Farm Bill has passed, this draft of the Farm Bill has passed the Agriculture Committee. That is only one step of the process. It is a long road ahead. And so the key thing here is going to be to call your representative and tell them, no, do not support this Farm Bill. We want a Farm Bill that supports small and mid-sized farmers and consumers. We don't want this big ag handout Farm Bill. So make sure, call your representatives. It's not to the House floor yet. We still have time. And if you're too afraid or you're hesitant to reach out, I understand totally. It can be very, very intimidating to reach out to your representatives. But remember, they work for you. You elected them. And we have some great resources too and templates available on the website that you can use to kind of carve out exactly what you want to say. We have some great resources. So feel free to go to Food and Water Watch's website. We can help coach you through. But please, please, please call your representatives and encourage them to vote no on this farm bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And talk to your neighbors and maybe your local farmers and others.
Spread the word. Spread the word. Yeah, absolutely. It is key to kind of build community support around this and really make sure that your representative and Congress knows that we do not want a farm bill that capitulates to big ag and especially these pesticide corporations and does not support our small farmers and our consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any kind of model legislation or language that's been put together that we could promote and say, this is what we want to see in the bill?
There is some great legislation out there. It's kind of spread all out. We have a bill from Angie Craig that has been introduced. Angie Craig is out of Minnesota. She's the ranking member of the Ag Committee, and she has a bill that would reinstitute full funding for SNAP and rescind a lot of these cuts that happened in the One Big Ugly Bill this summer. And it also targets the tariffs that Trump has implemented that really hurt our farmers. There's a bill from Representative Pingree and, weirdly enough, Thomas Massie, who a Republican and a Democrat, showing bipartisan support that would ensure that the glyphosate executive order that Trump recently did wouldn't go into effect. So there's a lot of bills out there. They're scattered around. We have a great resource on Food and Water Watch about all of them and what we're pointing to, because there is legislation out there that supports small farmers and supports consumers, but it's not this farm bill.
Yeah. Well, any final words then for the listeners who are concerned about, we've got the price of fertilizers going up, there are shortages of that, the farm bill is kind of taking us in the wrong direction. What would you say to people as a final word?
Have hope. Right now, it might seem very, very stressful with prices rising, but midterms are coming up. You can make your voice heard. Find community. A lot of people are concerned about this, whether it be online or I'm sure in your neighborhoods. Get out there, spread the word, and really make sure that Congress knows that you don't want this farm bill passed and you want support for both consumers at the grocery stores and these small farmers. Have hope. change will come, and I'm hoping for the better.
Yeah. And I think that's an excellent reminder that the elections are coming up, and this is a great time to be going to the candidate events and pressing them on this and putting them on the spot. Where are they going to make sure that we have a food security in the United States, or are they going to continue to put the power in the hands of the corporations that really don't care about our health
No.
and our safety?
Yeah, midterms are a great opportunity to show what you care about. Absolutely.
Great. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you for taking time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guests today were Kayla Dones and Lauren Borsheim. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
Lift our brothers and our sisters. We'll lift the people together, can overthrow the system. We'll